Welcome back to Four of a Kind podcast, where you will learn from real life experiences of amazing women and male allies too, who support our mission to increase women's representation in business leadership. You will hear from founders, investors, startups, corporate leaders, and our own journeys too. We want this podcast to empower you to go start that business, take that big job, and do it with confidence. So join us and exciting guests, and let's figure out what we can do to get there. Hi, everyone. This is Kelsey, and I'm very excited for this week's episode because we'll get to talk to another amazing entrepreneur, Shelby Kemper. I have known Shelby since college, pretty sure since college, as she grew up with one of my college roommates. Hi, Katie O.
Hi, Katie.
And is the most wonderful, energetic, and outgoing person I have ever met. True statement, Shelby. And that's not the only reason I am excited to have Shelby on. I am excited for Shelby to share her story with you because we are covering entrepreneurship two ways. It's like a very fancy meal. First is Shelby's path to building out the international practice at her pharmaceutical consulting firm, and also Shelby's role as an entrepreneur in the nonprofit space and building a healthcare nonprofit. I know we haven't talked a lot about nonprofits on the podcast so far, but I think it's an interesting piece of the business community that we forget is just as important and impactful as a profit-making business. So most recently, Shelby received her master's in public health from Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Shelby is also a pharmacist, receiving her PharmD from the University of Colorado, as well as a certificate in global public health. Shelby began her studies at the University of Washington, graduating with both a BA in Spanish and a BS in biology. All right. I don't think I forgot anything, but please let us know if so. So Shelby is what you would say well-educated, but I think her background is really a testament to her passion for the field of public health.
Definitely love learning, to say the least. And I just wanted to say thank you guys for having me on today. I'm so excited to be on the podcast. This is my first and hopefully not my last foray into the podcast space. Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for being on. And also joining us today is one of my co-hosts, Michelle.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much. And Shelby, we're so excited to have you on today.
So today we're going to hear about Shelby's journey from pharmacist to a leader in global health and pharmaceutical health system strengthening, as well as with the many nonprofit organizations she has founded, advised, and supported throughout that time. As I mentioned previously, I know there are so many lessons that cross over the for-profit and nonprofit worlds. And often we think of entrepreneurship in terms of, you know, the big payouts, the dollars raised in terms of, well, I guess dollars raised in nonprofit world works too, but that financial return. And at the end of the day, so many of the same skills are required to build and sustain a nonprofit organization as they are for a for-profit. And finally, I know Shelby has a very global view of the healthcare and pharmaceutical industries and would love to dive into that as well. Getting started, Shelby, can you give us a quick snapshot of your career? I know we mentioned a couple things here and there, but maybe help put the storyline together for our listeners.
Yeah, for sure. My journey really began with a love of travel in high school, and that sparked this desire to have some type of grown-up job that allowed me to work in other countries while doing something in the healthcare space. My mom is a pharmacist, and so she gingerly guided me towards that path, as our parents do.
Yeah.
While I was studying abroad in Spain in my last year of college, I ended up in pharmacy school, and I connected with a group of med students that had just been to Peru on a medical mission trip, a hospital network from Colorado. And we wanted to do something to improve health in that region of the world. And we're really focused on making a sustainable impact. So instead of providing clinical services, we began training rural community health workers. And community health workers are basically someone who has been elected by the people in their community. Sometimes they've been appointed by the Ministry of Health or local government to be in charge of everyone's healthcare in their community. Normally, it's a preventative healthcare role. Sometimes they do treatment, just depending on where you are in that part of the world. So it's been 10 years since I started this organization, and I really still love it. I'm also on the board of another nonprofit called Bridge to Health, and they provide comprehensive healthcare in the US and abroad, and they're in the planning stages of starting to work in the Amazon as well. Their founder and I did our master's in public health at Hopkins together. And so speaking of public health, while I was at Hopkins, I was working a lot in patient safety and in pharmaceutical health systems. I ended up interning and doing some contract work at the World Health Organization. And after I was with them for a while, I decided that I wanted to do more specific, really niche contract work in the most efficient and cost-effective way that I could. So now I have my own consulting business that specializes in pharmaceutical health system strengthening. And so I know that that's like a very long phrase, but basically that means that I'm working with medicines and drugs like antibiotics, things like that, on a national level, usually national, sometimes local or regional, but usually a national level, and trying to make that system more effective and better. So that's kind of an overview of my career thus far.
That's so amazing, firstly. And can you talk to us a little bit about how you decided to build that organization to help people?
Yeah, so our organization is called CU Peru, which stands for Comunidades Unidas Peru, which means United Communities Peru, but that's such a mouthful, so we've abbreviated it. But even really back at the early stage of starting this, sustainability was key for all of us who are involved. You know, I'd traveled a lot in my personal life, and I knew that volunteerism wasn't making a lasting impact anywhere that I'd seen it. And so when I say volunteerism, I'm talking about this idea of going on vacation and doing something charitable, but that's fleeting. You know, you're coming in and you're doing something and then you're leaving. And so it's a really fine line, because what often happens is you have groups that are uneducated about a topic, and they come in and they do what they think is helpful when they're really not addressing the needs of the community. So, you know, for example, people visit a rural village in Cambodia or the Amazon and they bring, you know, toys and coloring books and things like that. But the reality of the situation is these people need clean water. And while the toys are a nice gesture, they don't really improve anybody's life except for the tourist who feels good about giving gifts. So similar to what you guys do in this for-profit space, effective global health work should be built on the needs of the client, you know, or in this case, the people that we're helping. And so it should really be a collaborative process and not coming in and telling people, you know, what they need. We knew that from the get-go, the sustainability piece is key, and we didn't want to provide clinical services. Ethically, we were still in training, and then also for a sustainability piece. These community health workers were identified, you know, not just by us, but by the Peruvian Ministry of Health as people that needed to be trained and were sort of the first line of care. But because of resource constraints and how difficult it is to get around the jungle, they aren't trained very often, and if they are, it's really infrequent. So we created a curriculum based off of the World Health Organization's IMCI curriculum, the Integrated Management of Childhood Illness, and we started educating people on topics that were relevant and important. So in this part of the world, this is the poorest area in Peru, and pneumonia and diarrhea are the biggest killers of kids under the age of 5. So kids get respiratory infections that don't resolve and they aren't treated correctly with antibiotics. And then they get a secondary infection like pneumonia. And a lot of these households are still drinking river water, and that's full of parasites. And then they get diarrhea. And it's just really unfortunate because both of these are treatable and preventable. So we started talking to the Ministry of Health, other nonprofits that work in the area. And then we talked with our community health workers. And based on that, we've built this curriculum.
That's so amazing, because I remember when I was 16 years old, I went to Jamaica. I helped put a brick on some wall that became a school at some point, and I felt I contributed to the world. But your organization is actually doing something that impacts the local community and the world in general. So that's so amazing.
So I can give you a little context. The Amazon is a place that sounds like very sexy until you're there and the bugs are biting you and you're sweating and eating jungle armadillo, which I did not know was a thing until I ate one.
That is a thing. Okay.
It is. And I'm going to be honest, it's not very
always
good.
Always learning.
Yes. Oh. I'm probably the only person you've had on your podcast that can skin a monkey.
Oh, gosh. You know, to be fair, we have not asked all of our guests that question.
Well, now you can.
But now we can. And then we'll get back to you with the data.
Deal. So my nonprofit, we fly into Iquitos, which for those of you who are not familiar, is in northeastern Peru. It's the largest city in the a world with no roads that lead to it. So it's really a crazy place. There aren't very many cars. There's lots of small tuk-tuk, motocar things that drive around. And so, you know, because of that, there's, even though it's a city of, you know, 500,000 people, there's no McDonald's. There's nothing really that we see in a lot of other places that we travel. It's a really remote area. And then along the Amazon and its tributaries, there are, you know, villages. Each of these has a community health worker, and that person has been elected to be in charge of everyone's health care. On average, this person has a third to sixth grade education without much, you know, if any, formal training. And so our goal, and the goal of the Peruvian government as well, is that these people are able to identify life-threatening situations. That way you know when a person has to go to the next tier of care. The way that the jungle health system is set up, which is really interesting and really kind of speaks to the work that CU Peru has done, is, you know, you have people that get triaged sort of up this line of care, and they go to a health post, which has paramedic type person, and then they go to a district clinic, which has new doctor grads, and then to Iquitos, to the main hospital. And depending on how far away your village is, there are no roads connecting it. So sometimes you're 2 full days away by boat to getting to a real high tier of care where you could get a CAT scan, or you could have a baby that's breached and you could deliver that safely, or have a C-section. So it's interesting, and it's like nowhere else I've ever worked.
It sounds like your patients, the people you serve, have a lot of challenges. But in setting up an organization or an operation to help that population, what would you say are the biggest challenges or hurdles that you faced, or you and your partners faced, when trying to figure out how to best serve the community?
I mean, all of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to work in a place that you're not physically in. So wasn't able to just go down the street and talk to somebody from the Ministry of Health, nor like navigating a system that is at the time, you know, very informal. There are no websites or online presence. You know, every connection that we made was direct person to person. And so it was really hard to work in a place where the people we were serving had no phones or connectivity to the outside world. And things have changed over the last 10 years in terms of the influence of technology. And we also are more established as an organization. So, you know, it's hard to say like what has made the biggest impact there. Yeah. But in addition to that, too, it's the work ethic and efficiency and the standards of quality just really aren't the same. In the jungle, it takes me 3 days to set up a meeting. And then when I do, I show up 10 minutes early. And then the person's like having lunch at their house, or no one told me that they're actually on vacation. And so, you know, it's much harder.
Sounds really hard to manage. I keep thinking of this phrase that gets tossed around of know your customer. But in this case, there's so much education that you as the founder of this organization needed in order to be effective. And I think you can't just like drop in with a bucket of healthcare and go out and save the day. There are so many pieces involved. And I know in the healthcare industry, generally, there's a lot of complicating factors, but obviously in the situation you're in, that's tenfold's probably not accurate. It's probably 100, 1,000-fold. But one of the questions I had in this case, which I think also comes up in any business, is how do you know how far to go or when to expand? Or I feel if you're in the situation you're in and you're seeing problems with lack of access to technology, lack of access to transportation, low rates of education, obviously difficulty accessing basic healthcare, it would be really hard for one organization to do everything. I mean, in that sense, you're just the government. In some cases, but how do you stay focused on your mission while at the same time recognizing that there are these other issues and problems that may be great to figure out how to solve, but not stray too far from where you started?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that CU Peru has done really well is we, and maybe to a fault at this point, you know, now it's been 10 years, but we consistently edit ourselves. You know, we haven't taken on anything outside of educating community health workers because we want to make sure what we're doing is excellent before we scale up too much, before we expand into other areas. And it's a really tricky balance because we see all these things and we have all of these ideas and we have organizations that have approached us about wanting to create a Wi-Fi network in the jungle, which would be amazing and could change how we do healthcare. But, right. you know, is that really related to what we're doing? So we have just really said, like, we want to get great at educating the 120 or so community healthcare workers that show up at every training. And we really want to focus on that. And I think now at our 10-year mark, we're starting to think more about scaling up and maybe incorporating some technology into our teaching methodology. But we've really tried to get really good at what we're doing before we expand.
Yeah, I think that's really hard to do. I think it's harder than it sounds to edit. I know in so many different facets, it's the same question of the skill of saying no to things, which I think is a really hard skill mm-hmm. to develop and be good at and be confident
in. Yeah, I've yet to learn it. So I'm like such a yes person in my normal life. And I think because I've had so much experience with being so focused and so edited with my work in Peru, it's driven me the polar opposite direction in my professional life. And so now I'm looking really at health systems. I'm looking at how does capacity building influence access to medicine? How does supply chain change people's ability to get drugs? How is all of this influenced? How does our prescribing practices change how antibiotics are used? Yeah. And it's, I think, pushed me the opposite direction. And so now I'm really looking at the system as a whole. So it's kind of cool because I have, you know, one that's super, super focused and then the other that's really, really broad.
So correct me if I'm wrong. This is a thing that you do, but you also have a consulting firm that you work with. Can you talk a little bit about that?
No, you're totally right. So all my work with CU Peru has been for free for the last decade.
Wow.
So I've put in a lot of actual blood and sweat and actual tears into the work. But yeah, the business side of things, you know, it's interesting because there's a lot of ways that they cross over and that they're similar. So my consulting firm is called Kemper Pharmaceutical Services, and we work with governments and ministries of health in low-income countries. And when I say low-income, this is sort of a public healthy term that people have been using the past, you know, decade or so in the public health space. We basically stopped saying developing and developed world or third world or first world. So I'm working in these low and middle income countries and just trying to improve the pharmaceutical health system as a whole.
And in what ways do you feel like there's a lot of crossover in the skills and the skill set between the work you're doing in Peru? I mean, aside from the fact that it's healthcare.
Well, I think Peru has given me a lot of context for this health system space, because like you were saying earlier, Kelsey, I can see from a really, you know, close up lens all of these problems around education and transportation and housing and access to care. And I see all of those. And really, I think, intimately understand them after spending so much time in Peru. And so I think it's great because it gives me really informed context. I think I've also learned that connection between individuals is an extremely critical component. Like, I can't emphasize it enough in the majority of these low and middle income countries. I think it's a lot different than how we work in the Western world, in Europe and in the US. And so 10 years of work experience in the same place with the same people, I go to their house and I can see the difference in the relationships that I've really cultivated and invested in. And, you know, people whose children I know and who I bring gifts when I come, and versus those that are more transactional. A lot of the work that I'm doing now is really high systems level improvements. So having this field experience, it keeps everything in perspective, and it keeps all these policies and antibiotic guidelines, all of these things that are really high level and that often will be passed down onto clinicians or government leaders rather than like the people that we're actually trying to help. So it helps keep that like back of my mind whenever I'm creating those documents.
Do you think that this connecting with individuals on the very ground level, is that part of what helped you drive this pivot in your career? And I'm asking this question because it's a little bit scary to try something new and do something new. And the co-host and I, we all talk about it a lot, but you've actually gone out and you've done that. So can you talk a little bit about that thought process?
So, you know, when I was in pharmacy school, I was working a lot, you know, one-on-one with patients, and that didn't really resonate with me. And through my own personal travels and time with CU Peru, I really found myself being pulled more towards population-focused health. And so, I mean, it sounds like I'm in a new space, but it's kind of a continuation from what I was doing. I draw on a lot of that pharmacy knowledge often, even though I'm not like in a hospital making IV chemo drugs. But the newness of all of it has been fun and also stressful. I feel like I'm learning how, and I know Kelsey, you're working in the consulting space, so you probably feel this way too, but I'm learning how to walk this line of being an expert, you know, AKA a consultant, but figuring out, you know, the nuances and details of how things work as I go. And a lot of this business side of things is really new to me. You know, I come from a clinical background and public health, which is soft science. So I don't have a lot of experience with spreadsheets and budgets. And it's just a really different mentality to focus on numbers that are dollar signs and not like people that are being treated. So it's been interesting. And then, you know, I think it's also, you know, just new is always a weird place. And I think I've really learned through professional and CU Peru work that struggle really breeds growth. And so I'm constantly trying to embrace the new. It's an uncomfortable space sometimes.
I think that's right. And I was thinking, even starting in consulting fairly recently, sometimes on the face of it, you think that there aren't a lot of skills that overlap, but sometimes we don't give ourselves credit for everything we've learned along the way, whether to your point, it's just the value of interacting with people and building relationships, which is not on your resume, right? We take for granted as being valuable or easily transferable when really they are. And obviously you have great knowledge on which to build a lot of these other things in terms of being a subject matter expert that will take you really far. Anyway, that's not really a question. That's just my own thought.
I totally agree. I take so much stock and value in that connection piece and the building relationships that when I was at Hopkins, I actually started teaching a seminar about how to network, because I feel like this is a skill that is so important and that no one actually teaches you. And so every year I go back to Hopkins and I teach MPH PhD students how to network. Like, how do you hand someone your business card? How do you have these conversations? How do you begin these relationships? And then once you have them, how do you facilitate them? And I think, if I do say so myself, I'm a really fantastic networker. And I think
this is true.
Love it.
This is very true.
Yes,
when
I'm learning.
I started this off saying Shelby was energetic and outgoing. That is definitely one of the reasons she's great at networking. But it's a little more complex than that, as I'm sure you teach in your class.
Yes, but you know, this is part of my being in the business world. I'm learning to advocate for myself. You know, public health is very collaborative, and being on the for-profit side, I feel like you learn to sell yourself a little bit. So I'm going to toot my own horn about my networking abilities. But yeah, it's, I think, a really interesting skill, and nobody really talks about it. And it's something that we are all expected to learn, and nobody ever tells us how. And it's an extra element of challenge, because I talk a lot to international students. So if you're coming from a different country where people would normally never email their superior and ask mentorship or questions like that, how do you do that? How do you network in a place that you don't speak the language as your first language? And so a lot of these things, I think the connection piece is just, it's so important. And even though I can't really put those soft conversational skills on my resume, I feel like they are one of the most invaluable things you can learn.
I mean, maybe we should put that on our resume, because it is valuable. And I know Michelle always has good insight on the points you made about mentoring and those relationships. But I was just thinking, when Michelle and I were in Japan, oh my gosh, like a year and a half ago, that's crazy.
So long ago. Oh my gosh.
We literally had to have a lesson in how to properly hand our business card over to the executives we were meeting with.
Yeah,
I still mess it up all the time. And I meet with Japanese customers on a regular basis.
Couldn't even explain it properly, so I turned it wrong. But I remember, you know, that there was a way.
And you touched on a number of things too, like developing relationships and having a mentor guide you through these processes is also very important and influential in how your organization or your career develops. How did you identify who those people were or would be in your life, in your career, in developing and growing your organizations? And perhaps also, what advice did they give you while you were working through everything?
You know, I think mentors are really difficult to find in general, but especially so when you've taken an untraditional path like I have. I mean, I know very few PharmDs that also have a master's in public health, and then a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of them work in global health. There's probably like 25 of us that do this. I mean, it's small. So, you know, it's not like I'm in a hospital and I have an attending that I can just go to and ask for guidance or advice. And I think it's doubly difficult by having my own consulting business because, you know, I'm the expert, and being your own boss is really hard and doesn't lead itself to a lot of mentorship. With that being said, I met some really great professors when I was at Hopkins who are at the top of their fields and have worked in a lot of these spaces for a long time. And they have been really great in giving me a lot of ideas and the ability to bounce my future career path and things like that off of them. But it's hard because all these relationships are really self-managed when you're not in a professional setting that curates them for you. So you really only get what you put in. And so you have to be really dedicated and committed to managing your own relationship with this informal mentor. And what I feel like I've done is gone on LinkedIn and I've seen the few people who are doing what I do that are great at it. And I've reached out and just contacted them directly and tried to sort of create my own mentorship. But, you know, I always want more guidance and mentorship. And I think it's so hard to find. And I think there's a huge deficit. And I think as a result, I'm trying to be the mentor that I wish I had. So I mentor a lot of students coming out of Hopkins that work in the pharmacy space and want to do so internationally, or want to work specifically in health system strengthening, or have an interest in the jungle. I'm trying to be the mentor that I wish I had.
I love that. I think we can often throw around, well, obviously you have a mentor and obviously it's this person or this kind of person. And it can be a lot more complicated, or you can't just go out and buy one. So it matters, I think, the value, the strength of the relationship, the quality of the relationship, rather than having a bunch. I know Michelle's put a lot of work in at her company and at least providing the opportunity to have that conversation and find people. And it's not, you know, a perfect match all the time, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I think it's really important also to think about the types of mentorship. You know, some of the people who I really value their professional advice are maybe not the people that I would go to for some of the more personal aspects of the professional world, like how to manage a relationship or to deal with a difficult boss. You know, sometimes those people aren't the same ones that I would say, like, hey, you know, I got offered this speaking engagement. How much do I charge for this? You know, help me out here. What do I do? It's helped me to parse out the types of mentorship I receive and who I receive them from, and to really cultivate those types of relationships, because I think it's the same as having a partner. You know, you're not going to get everything from that one person. And just being honest yourself about what you're getting, I think, makes that relationship just much more rich and beneficial.
And before we wrap up, speaking of mentoring, what is your own best advice for our listeners?
So I would say my best advice is to embrace the uncomfortable sort of sticky parts, and that's growth really happens. And so for people like myself who are on an untraditional career path, sometimes it feels like we're failing because we aren't hitting the same milestones and benchmarks that a lot of our counterparts and our friends are who have a more traditional career path. You know, there's not one promotion after another or a raise, but I would just encourage all of you and myself oftentimes to keep going and to just put in your energy and your effort and your all really into it. And then, you know, from the nonprofit side of things in the jungle, I would say to always pack toilet paper.
Very practical advice.
Yeah, you know, I had a student once, I won't say his name because he would kill me, but had some stomach issues in the jungle, and he ended up using a leaf, and the leaf was some type of poison ivy or something.
Oh my God.
And
his life just got so much more complicated after that. So. Yeah. It's really, I'm saying this from experience. It's sound.
Check. Well, on that note, thank you so much, Shelby, for sharing your story with us, inspiring our listeners, and hopefully inspiring them not only in their what we call grown-up day jobs, but also in ways that they can go out and help whether it's their communities, work similar to what you're doing in Peru and low-income countries. I think there are a lot of opportunities to follow a similar path. What is the best way for our listeners to get in touch with you to learn more about KPS, CU Peru, and Bridge to Health?
You can reach out on all of our websites. That's usually the easiest. KPS, our website, is kpharmservices.com. CU Peru is cuperu.org. And Bridge to Health is bridgetohealth.ca. You can always find me on my LinkedIn profile, too. That's also a great way to get in touch with me as well.
Shelby, it was so great chatting with you today. Thank you so much for taking the time to share your story with us and with our listeners. And for our listeners, you can also check out more details on today's episode in the show notes.
Can I make a quick plug, you guys, for
totally
people who are in the for-profit space? I would definitely encourage you to find an organization or a cause that you're committed to and join the board of that organization. Your business expertise and acumen is desperately needed. And we all really appreciate having people who are such big players in their fields and who are, you know, well-versed and have a passionate time commitment. Joining a board a lot of times is, you know, just a few hours a month. So I would definitely advocate. And I think that it's helped me a lot professionally. And so I would really encourage all of you to go out and find a cool board to join.
I think that's a great point and definitely one that's super valuable. And maybe we should have an episode on that.
I agree. We may have even already put that on our list because it is, in fact, such a great point.
You guys, we didn't even plan that.
I know we did not, but
that's amazing.
As always, if you'd like to reach us, send us an email at fourofakindpodcast@gmail.com. Or you can also follow us on Instagram at fourofakindpodcast for the latest news and updates. And don't forget to hit subscribe and rate us on iTunes or whenever you get your podcast.
Thank you so much. This really was, it was so lovely. And I just really appreciate the opportunity and thanks. I'm happy that my first podcast was with you guys.
Thank you. We are happy your first podcast was with us because I feel like you're going to have many more and will just be a distant memory. But thank you so much. And thank you to all our listeners for joining and have a great weekend, everyone.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.